Before getting into the meat of what I want to say here this evening, I thought it might be helpful to give a little bit more background, just sort of a timeline, as it were, of Jonathan Edwards, just to give you a little bit more context about his life before we consider the second part, which I brought up to you this morning. Well, quickly, just to run through this, again, Jonathan Edwards was born on October the 5th, 1703, in East Windsor, Connecticut, and as I mentioned this morning, I believe technically it is now in South Windsor. And if you go to Main Street on in the historical district of South Windsor, you'll see this road sign that's on the screen behind me here that marks the spot of where Jonathan Edwards was born. And so if you go to this place, it's only about 15 minutes from here across the river, you can perhaps imagine what life was like for young Jonathan as he perhaps ran through some of the fields that are around there in the woods and maybe even examine a spider or two, as we talked about this morning. On the screen, this is a drawing of the house that Jonathan grew up in. That house is not there, so if you're looking for that, you're not going to find it. There's a modern home on top of that location. This week, when I was doing some of this research here and looking at these pictures, I noticed someone online mentioned that this was the house that Jonathan Edwards grew up in, and it was a picture of this modern house. It was probably built in the 1980s or 90s. But so if you go there, that's not it. This is a better rendering of what he actually grew up in. It was the house of Timothy Edwards, as I mentioned this morning. And also on Main Street there in the historical part of South Windsor, if you go down to the right, just about a quarter of a mile from his birthplace, you will see a cemetery that is actually named after Jonathan Edwards. But if you're trying to find his tombstone there, you won't find it, because even though it's named after him, he is not there. He is buried at Princeton University. But his father, Timothy Edwards, and his mother, Esther Stoddard Edwards, is buried in that cemetery over in South Windsor. Timothy Edwards was a godly, pious man, and actually the first pastor of the Second Church of Windsor, which at that time was known as East Windsor, but we know it today as South Windsor. So I don't know if you got all of those first, seconds, and Windsors in there, but that is where he was at. Anyway, Jonathan Edwards' father, Timothy, faithfully pastored the church, the Second Church of Windsor, known in that area as Windsor Farms, for 64 years. He faithfully pastored that church. And if you ever go to that place, there's his tombstone, and as you can kind of see here, it's one of those sort of tabletop tombstones that are common for folks that were buried in that era. And it's just a wonderful epitaph. You can't really read it clearly, not only because of the wear and tear over the years on the top of that, but also because of the old script. But let me read his epitaph. It's quite stirring, I think. It says, "In memory of the Reverend Mr. Timothy Edwards, pastor of the Second Society in Windsor, whose singular gifts and piety rendered him an excellent, and in the judgment of charity, by the blessing of heaven, a successful minister of the gospel, who died January 27th, AD 1758, in the 89th year of his age and 64th of his ministry, and his remains buried under this stone." And then the epitaph: "The man of God who nobly pled his master's cause, alas, is dead. His voice no more, but awful urn, still speaks to men their great concern. His praise on souls by heaven impresses. This moldering stone will long outlast. When grace completes the work begun, bright saints will shine his living crown." The Puritans knew how to give a proper tribute. Well, as I just read from that epitaph, Edwards lived to the age, Timothy Edwards lived to the age of 89, and he died in 1758. Now, if any of you here this evening are really good with numbers and you can remember the date of Jonathan Edwards' date, you'll remember that that is the same exact year that Jonathan Edwards died, 1758. Jonathan Edwards died just 2 months after his father died, and again, Jonathan died at a rather young age, age 54, and yet during his short life, the Lord used him to accomplish many wonderful things. Again, just to continue our timeline here, at the age of 13, he went off to Yale to begin his undergraduate studies. And some of you may be aware that at that particular time, it was just for a short stint, Yale was actually located in Wethersfield. And so that's where he began his studies, and then it was moved to its current location there in New Haven, where he completed his bachelor's and master's degree. As a 19-year-old, he briefly gave pulpit supply to a small Presbyterian church in New York City. He did that for 8 months. And then at age 20, he received the call to his first pastorate. It was the church in Bolton, Connecticut. And the Lord, he felt, clearly led him there, and he did, but he was only there for a short time before the Lord moved him on. It was just a matter of a few months before he received his call to the post of teaching at Yale University in New Haven. At age 23, he was ordained and became the assistant pastor to his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, at the church in Northampton, Massachusetts. And we need to understand that that really was one of the most prestigious and influential churches in all of the New England colonies, really the most prestigious church outside of the churches there in Boston. And his father, his grandfather, rather, was immensely influential, a very powerful man. He wielded a lot of influence over this particular area of the colonies. In fact, Solomon Stoddard was sometimes called the Protestant Pope of the Connecticut River Valley. Well, in 1729, upon the death of his grandfather, Jonathan Edwards became the sole pastor at Northampton. And during his pastorate, he, of course, continued his very prolific writing ministry. And he was also, as probably most of you are aware, one of the key leaders, along with George Whitefield and Gilbert Tennent, in America's first Great Awakening that broke out in the colonies and went from basically 1740 to 1742. As I mentioned this morning, his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of Angry God, is often considered sort of the high watermark of that awakening. And I'm sure many of you have driven past on Route 5 there in Enfield this stone, which marks the place where he preached that remarkable sermon. What a lot of people don't know is during that same week, he also preached across the river in Suffield. And that particular town was known for great spiritual vitality, and the Lord did a great work there as well. Yeah, we need to understand, not all was smooth sailing for Edwards, as probably many of you are aware. Controversy visited the Northampton Church over the requirements for partaking in the Lord's Supper. Edwards rightly believed that the participant in the Lord's Supper should be a genuine believer. They had to have a genuine experience of conversion, be able to recount that in testimony. He was right about that. And he believed that just because someone was baptized as an infant, that wasn't enough. But unfortunately, the church there in Northampton didn't see eye to eye with him on that particular issue. And so they dismissed Edwards as their pastor. Well, from Northampton in 1751, Edwards went to the Frontier Church in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. There he ministered as a sort of missionary pastor to the Native Americans. And although his ministry in Stockbridge was not as prestigious as his ministry in Northampton, it certainly was a very fruitful ministry. And some of his happiest days were there in Stockbridge. And he also saw a lot of fruit come out of that time in terms of his writing ministry. He had more time to write, so he took advantage of that. It was during that time, for example, 1754, that Edwards wrote his classic work on the freedom of the will, which is just a wonderful classic expression of a Calvinistic understanding regarding the will of man, and is a nice complement to Luther's bondage of the will. Well, in late 1757, Edwards accepted the presidency of Princeton University, at that time just known as the College of New Jersey. He arrived there in January of 1758, but it was short after his arrival that he contracted smallpox, and he died on March 22nd, 1758, And that date is rather easy for me to remember, March 22nd, because that's the same day as my wife's birthday. I don't know what that says about me. Maybe I'm just weird, but it helps me to remember that date. Well, the writings of Edwards had a great influence on American and British Protestantism for a century after his death. But after the American Civil War, there was a sharp decline in interest regarding Edwards. His prestige among scholars dipped. And sadly, that was basically because there was just a general revolt against Puritanism and Calvinism during the 18th century going, or rather the 19th century going into the 20th. But in the first half of the 20th century, theologians, philosophers, and historians were beginning to change. They were beginning to change their view of the Puritans and Edwards as an intellect. They began to again appreciate these people, and specifically Edwards, for the great intellects they were and the great Christians they were. Well, by the second half of the 20th century and all the way up to today, to the present, interest in the Puritans, and specifically Jonathan Edwards, has just absolutely exploded. Harvard professor Perry Miller's work in the 1930s and 40s really set off this wave of studies on Edwards, and it really sent a ripple effect throughout all corners of the academy. As I mentioned this morning, even non-Christian scholars today recognize Edwards as a towering intellect. In fact, just the number of dissertations that are now done on Jonathan Edwards in various fields has skyrocketed over the last 50 years in particular. Esteemed historian Stephen J. Stein notes that Jonathan Edwards is indisputably a significant figure in American history. His publications and his personal influence on a subsequent generation on religious leaders assured that his theological legacy would continue after his death. The impact of Edwards' ideas expanded with the passage of time. The year 2003 marked the tercentenary of Edwards' birth. Numerous gatherings and professional meetings focused on that anniversary. Scholarly conferences took place at such diverse locations as Princeton Theological Seminary, Calvin College, and the Library of Congress. Publications on Edwards abounded in that year. Notre Dame historian George M. Marsden, in a prize-winning biography, declared Edwards the most acute early American philosopher and the most brilliant of all American theologians. Avihu Zakkai, a historian at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, noted that Edwards is no less celebrated as a prominent philosopher, ethicist, and moralist. E. Brooks Holyfield, a historian of Christian thought at Emory University, asserted that no other theologian in America was equal to Edwards in intellectual depth. Cultural historian Richard Whiteman Fox observed that Edwards influenced believers on both sides of the Atlantic. So like I said this morning, we, in approaching Edwards, could look at him from a lot of different angles. As I mentioned this morning, he is carefully studied by Christian and non-Christian scholars alike at the highest level of the academy, whether you're talking about historians or cultural critics or psychologists or sociologists or ethicists, whether you're talking about missiologists or you're talking about theologians or homileticians or scientists, educators, many of these folks reflect on and they interact with Jonathan Edwards, the man, as well as his very extensive writings. But tonight, as I mentioned this morning, I want us to look again at and learn from the family legacy of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards. As I said this morning, they are exceptional examples of blamelessness and family life that modern Christians should imitate. Again, this morning we looked at Jonathan and Sarah Edwards as example husband and wife, and tonight we're going to learn from them as example father and mother. In his last sermon at Northampton, known as his farewell sermon, or what at least should have been his farewell sermon, he actually came back after his last Lord's Day there to do some pulpit supply for them at their request. I can't imagine him doing that, but he was gracious enough to do that even though they kicked him out. And in that discourse, the rejected pastor urged his flock to remember every Christian family ought to be, as it were, a little church consecrated to Christ and wholly influenced and governed by his rules. So, although Edwards' congregation rejected him over his views on communion, they could not find fault with him when it came to his parenting. He could speak authoritatively on this topic to the very end because both he and Sarah practiced what he preached. Just as Edwards took his charge to pastor the Northampton Church with utmost seriousness, he also took his charge as a father to shepherd, to pastor his family with equal earnestness. Because Edwards is such an exemplary father, even his fierce of opponents on his final Sunday there, his farewell sermon, they had to sit up and pay attention to what this man of God was saying regarding the family. They had to listen to his final instructions. Again, to quote from his farewell sermon, he said, "Let me now, therefore, once more, before I finally cease to speak to this congregation, repeat the counsel which I have often urged on heads of families here while I was their pastor, to great painfulness in teaching, warning, and directing their children, bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, beginning early where there is yet opportunity, and maintaining a constant diligence in labors of this kind, remembering that as you would not have all your instructions and counsels ineffectual, there must be government as well as instructions, which must be maintained with an even hand and steady resolution as a guard to the religion and morals of the family and the support of its good order. Take heed that it be'nt with any of you as it was with Eli of old, who reproved his children, but restrained them not, and that by this means you do not bring the like curse on your families as he did on his. And let children obey their parents and yield to their instructions and submit to their orders as they would inherit a blessing and not a curse." I think those words by Edwards help reveal that above all, Edwards was very deeply concerned for the spiritual condition of his family. Kim Kistler explains, as a husband and father, the care and the oversight of his family was thoroughly spiritual. He took seriously anything that troubled his children and would save the evening hours to be spent in prayer and close fellowship with his family. Primarily concerned for the condition of their souls, Edwards taught each of his children to earnestly seek salvation, to have God our friend, and to be united to Christ. Well, consistent with his Puritan theology, Edwards believed that his children were conceived in iniquity. They were totally depraved, pervasively corrupt, and therefore in dire need of God's saving grace. And so he always kept their eternal destinies before their eyes. We see this concern for their salvation evidenced in a particular letter, 1749. It was a letter to his daughter Mary. She was a 15-year-old girl at this time, and she was away from home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And in this, we see that Edwards, yes, he was concerned for her physical well-being, but he was far more concerned for her spiritual well-being. He wrote, "My dear child, you may well think it is natural for a parent to be concerned for a child at so great a distance, so far out of view, and so far out of the reach of communication, where, if you should be taken with any dangerous sickness that should issue in death, you might probably be in your grave before we could hear of your danger. But yet, my greatest concern is not for your health or temporal welfare, but for the good of your soul. My desire and daily prayer is that you may meet with God where you are and have much of his divine influences on your heart. I hope that you will maintain a strict and constant watch over yourself against all temptations, that you do not forsake and forget God, and particularly that you do not grow slack in secret religion. Retire often from this vain world and seek effectually for that divine grace and comfort, the least drop of which is worth more than all the riches, gaiety, pleasures, and entertainments of the whole world." These type of soul-searching letters were very typical of Jonathan Edwards as he corresponded with his children in letters. I'll give you a few more examples. Upon the death of a friend that was 10 years old, a Native American, 10-year-old Jonathan Jr. received this letter from his father, which urged upon him to consider his own mortality, his own death, and the condition of his soul. Edwards wrote to his son, "This is a loud call of God to you to prepare for death. Never give yourself any rest unless you have good evidence that you are converted." Another example, Edwards, after hearing that his 14-year-old son, his eldest son, Timothy, was sick with fever, he wrote, "Whether you are sick or well, like to die or like to live, I hope you are earnestly seeking your salvation. Indeed, God often hears the poor, miserable cries of sinful, vile creatures who have no manner of true regard to him in their hearts. For he is a God of infinite mercy, and he delights to show mercy for his son's sake, who is worthy, though you are unworthy, who came to save the sinful and the miserable, yea, some of the chief of sinners. Therefore, there is your only hope, and in him must be your refuge, who invites you to come to him and says, 'Him that cometh to me, I will no wise cast out.'" Of course, Edwards' letters were not only about urging his children to repent of their sins and embrace Christ as Savior. He also expressed just typical, normal parental concerns in his letters. For instance, in one letter to his son Timothy, he reminds his son to write him because he hasn't heard from him in some time, and he was eager to hear how he was doing and how his studies were and what the events were going on at Princeton. In this same letter, the thoughtful father also enclosed some new stockings and some money for his son as well. Additionally, as a tender father, Edwards also offered parental advice in his letters. This is reflected, for example, in one letter he sent to his daughter Esther. He sent this letter in 1752, sometime after she married Aaron Burr Sr. But in March of 1753, she was contending with illness, and she was also quite homesick. And so Edwards advised his daughter to be thankful for divine consolations and also for that unwearied kindness and tender care of your companion, Reverend Burr, which you speak of. I find that advice interesting. Rather than pointing his daughter to himself, he points her to her heavenly father, and he also points her back to her husband, Aaron Burr Sr. The concerned father then went on to counsel her not to think it a strange thing that this affliction has befell her. After all, this is according to the course of things in this world. And then the father advised her to find rest and prosperity in the Lord, not in this world. And then he went on to give some medical advice to Esther. He told her to be sure to take the rattlesnake medicine that he sent her, as well as the ginseng root that he sent her. He also advised her to ride on horseback and to avoid doctors. Now, granted, I don't think we as parents today would follow Edwards' advice when it comes to medicine, but there's no doubt that he had a genuine love and concern for his children. Of course, Edwards not only expressed spiritual and physical concern for his children while they were away from home, he also provided loving and a systematic soul care for them at home. You remember this morning I mentioned Samuel Hopkins. He was a ministerial apprentice that stayed with the Edwards for some time, so he had sort of a front row seat to all the inner workings of the Edwards home. And he relays in his firsthand account the daily routine of the Edwards home when he says, as he arose, meaning Jonathan Edwards, when he arose very early himself, he was wont to have his family up betimes in the morning, after which, before they entered on the business of the day, he attended on family prayers, when a chapter in the Bible was read, commonly by candlelight in the winter, upon which he asked his children questions according to their age and capacity, and took occasion to explain some passages in it. He took opportunities to converse with his children singly and closely about the concerns of their souls and to give them warnings, exhortations, and directions as he saw them severely needed. In the evening, after tea, he customarily sat in the parlor with his family for an hour, entering freely into the feelings and concerns of his children and relaxing into cheerful and animated conversation, accompanied frequently with sprightly remarks and sallies of wit and humor. But before retiring to his study, he usually gave the conversation by degrees a more serious turn, addressing his children with great tenderness and earnestness on the subject of their salvation. He took much pains to instruct his children in the principles of and the duties of religion, in which he made use of the assembly's shorter catechism, not merely by taking care that they learned it by heart, but by leading them into an understanding of the doctrines therein taught, by asking them questions on each answer and explaining it to them. His usual time to attend to this was on the evening before the Sabbath. So that eyewitness account gives us a peek into the pastoral care that Edwards provided his family. And what we see here, as Hopkins notes, is that Edwards did a series of things in the typical day. He would lead them in morning prayers, and then he would read the Bible with them. They would ask his children questions about their Bible reading, and then he would also interject his own insights. He informally gave spiritual guidance to them throughout the day, and he used the evening family time to address their salvation. Quote also shows us that he catechized his children, and he also wanted to make sure that they comprehended the answers, not that they could just spit them out. And then he had evening prayers with his children. It's not given in that particular quote from Hopkins, but we also know that Edwards felt it was very important that his children know Jewish and church history. In fact, he expected his kids to know the chronology of the Bible, biblical events, and be able to correlate, put together Old Testament passages with New Testament passages. His children never knew when they might be called upon at the dinner table to answer one of his questions, and he wanted them to be able to answer it in a rather crisp manner. For example, he would ask them questions like, how long was it after the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar until Babylon was destroyed by Cyrus? Anybody know that, by the way? Right. Okay, so Jonathan Edwards were like you, so you knew that. All right. But a lot of us wouldn't know that answer, but he expected his kids to know that quickly. Well, in addition to the spiritual disciplines of family worship and catechetical instruction, Edwards also consistently practiced corrective discipline. As I alluded to this morning, both he and Sarah were on the same page in this regard. They both felt it was very important for the spiritual formation of the children to be disciplined in a biblical way. So they were unified in this. They did not, as Edwards put it, weaken one another's hands in this work, one parent disapproving what the other doth, one smiling upon a child while the other frowns, one protecting while the other corrects. When things in a family are thus, he added, children are likely to be undone. Now, like Sarah, as I mentioned this morning, Jonathan Edwards didn't use corporal punishment that often, but when he did so, we are told by Hopkins, with great calmness. So Edwards wasn't one of these guys, as unfortunately we see, who kind of lashes out at his kids, barks at them, is harsh with them. He was calm. He was gentle with them. Having observed Edwards administer discipline, Samuel Hopkins recounts, exercising discipline once or twice was generally sufficient for that child and effectually established his parental authority and produced a cheerful obedience ever after. Hopkins also goes on to state that when Edwards and his wife did discipline their children, the kids did not resent them for doing so. Instead, as Hopkins says, the children reverenced, esteemed, and loved their father for disciplining them. There were two basic goals that Jonathan Edwards had when he disciplined his children, the same two goals that we should have as parents. One was to prepare them for salvation through the discipline, and the other was to help them grow as Christians once they were believers. So So corporal discipline, I hope we understand, is an important part of making disciples of our children, but we also need to understand that's not the only part. There are other lessons that we as parents have to teach our children if we're to train them up in the Lord. One of those lessons that the Edwards thought was important was wise stewardship of money. Careless spending was not an option in the Edwards home. In fact, the savings of each child, the borrowings, the expenditures were all recorded in the family Bible. How would you like that for your family Bible? As another vital part of child rearing, Jonathan and Sarah instructed their children on how to set apart the Lord's Day. They taught them this both through example as well as through verbal instruction. They taught the sobriety as well as the joy of that special day, the market day of the soul, as the Puritans called it, the most important day of the week, the day that should be a highlight for Christians. Elizabeth Dodd comments, perhaps the most formative feature in the development of these children was the sense of privilege they felt as a minister's family on the great occasion of Sunday. Puritans took seriously the admonition to rest on the Sabbath. After Sunday, on Saturday, no one could work at all. They couldn't even make beds. So a Puritan housewife shined her house on Saturday and did a colossal baking. Then after 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, the mood of expectancy began to build up to the pivotal day. These people really believed that Sunday would bring encounter with a living and dependable God. Shoes were signed, clothes were laid out for the next day, and modesty pieces ironed. Father, abstracted, would be finishing his two sermons for the next day. Then on Saturday night, the family sang a psalm together, had prayers, and went upstairs to bed with a sense of anticipating drama, as children now only have on Christmas Eve. We might look at some of those applications and maybe not quite line up with them, but we have to respect the idea that they were earnestly trying to make Sunday a special day of worship. There's no doubt that Jonathan Edwards ran an orderly home, but let me say it would be a mistake for us to think that this orderliness somehow led to a lack of affection for his children. That was certainly not the case. Fact is Edwards sacrificially, warmly, and sweetly gave of himself to his children. He had a Christ-like spirit of love, and that love reigned in the Edwards home. His love for his offspring started with his love for their mother by showing her tenderness, by showing her respect. Jonathan gave his children the gift of security. Those children never doubted that their mother and father loved one another. And because they never doubted that, they never had to doubt that their mother and father loved them. Besides loving their mother, Jonathan Edwards wrapped another warm security blanket around his children, that of comfortable conversation. Now, I know I mentioned this morning that Edwards was sometimes as regarded as somewhat deficient in some of his social skills with those in his congregation. But that wasn't the case when it came to his family or with his closest friends. He was quite comfortable with them. He had a very warm and close relationship with his children. And no doubt that was the result of him investing a whole lot of time in them. The esteemed theologian was able to give sage advice on a child's level. And perhaps even more importantly, he also learned the important art of tenderly listening to each child's concern. Further, he spent individual time each day with each of his children. As I mentioned this morning, even though he spent 13 hours in study each day, he made sure to carve out special time, small portions of the day for each child to give them undivided attention. As I mentioned just a moment ago, he, of course, carved out those formal times that he had with all of his children each day, family devotions, meal times, an evening hour in the parlor. But Edwards also carved out informal times with his children. For example, he took one of his sons on an adventure to Mount Tom. And I'm not sure exactly how they did it, but they went about trying to measure that mountain. Also, he took one of his children often with him on horseback whenever he traveled to other churches. And these trips allowed his children to participate with him in his ministry, and it also gave him time to shepherd their souls with spiritual conversation. Edwards carefully obeyed the charge given in Deuteronomy 6:7 to fathers. Passage says, teach. Fathers should teach God's commandments diligently to their children, to talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. Edwards did that. And as a result, by God's grace, he saw good fruit. He invested much time in his children. And as a result, they felt very comfortable with him. They would approach him. He was very accessible. They would unburden themselves to him. And we see a lot of evidence of this in their letters. And indeed, the perhaps greatest evidence that Jonathan and Sarah Edwards loved their children is seen in the fact that their children reciprocated love back to them and respect back to them. As I mentioned this morning, their cheerful and immediate obedience was one manifestation of their love and respect for their parents. Proper manners was another manifestation. As Hopkins observed, in their manners, they were uncommonly respectful to their parents. When their parents came into the room, they all rose instinctively from their seats and never resumed them until their parents were seated. And when either parent was speaking, they were all immediately silent and attentive. The kind and gentle treatment they received from their mother while she maintained her parental authority seemed naturally to promote a filial respect and affection and to lead them to a mild, tender treatment of each other. So this kind of respect for the parents, we're told, was not due to some kind of servile fear. It was motivated instead by a genuine affection. Jonathan Edwards' adult daughter, Esther, expresses such affection in one of her journal entries. She was visiting her parents in Stockbridge at that time. And she says that she and her father were having a conversation about spiritual matters, or as she says, soul concerns. After which she wrote in her journal this: last eve, I had some free discourse with my father on the greatest things that concern my best interest. He gave me some excellent directions to be observed in secret that tend to keep the soul near to God, as well as others to be observed in a more public way. What a mercy that I have such a father, such a guide. Another evidence of sincere love for parents in the Edwards home is seen in how Lucy and Esther cared for their father on his deathbed. But given their authentic affection for the parents, it's not surprising that the Edwards children sought to emulate their parents and they tried to carry out the legacy, the godly legacy that they were given. Out of the 11 Edwards children, Jerusha Edwards was the only one who did not survive her parents. She died at the young age of 17. And we hear that, and we think that's horrible, and of course it is in one sense, but for that day, it's remarkable that out of 11 children, only one died at a young age. That was rare. And so the Edwards were viewed as uniquely blessed of God, and in fact, unfortunately, some people even envied them for having so many children. Well, anyway, Jerusha died young, and yet as her father could testify, in her 17 years of life, she displayed much spiritual fruit. In fact, David Brainerd, who Jerusha actually nursed to health on one occasion, concurred with Edwards' estimation. Brainerd referred to Jerusha as a very eminent saint. And her Christ-likeness really is representative of the other 10 Edwards' children. Her sister Esther, who went on to marry Aaron Burr Sr., who was also a pastor and president of Princeton. Esther, she could sincerely speak of giving up everything for the cause of God, even to burn at a stake. Esther's piety is also reflected in how she responded to the death of her husband in a letter that she wrote to her mother. You see how she trusted in the sovereignty of God, and because she did, she could refer to God as an all-sufficient God, a full fountain of all good. Esther was also, in case you're wondering, was the mother of Aaron Burr Jr., who would go on to be the third vice president of the United States. And I won't get into him because he's a whole other issue. The eldest daughter, Sarah Jr., or more commonly referred to as Sally, demonstrated godliness even during very trying times. For example, when she was grieving over the death of her sister Esther, she wrote to her other sister Mary and expressed the desire for God's dealings to be sanctified in these hard circumstances. Speaking of Mary, she went on to marry Timothy Dwight Jr., and together they had a son that they also named Timothy Dwight. He would go on to be president of Yale, and he would be a key figure in the Second Great Awakening. And of his mother Mary, Jonathan's daughter, Timothy Dwight wrote, "All that I am and all that I shall be, I owe to my mother." Another Edwards daughter, Lucy, married after Jonathan Edwards died, and she went on to have 9 children. And in the words of her brother, Jonathan Jr., she was a pious woman. Susanna, like her sisters, also had God at the center of her affections. In a letter after her father died, she requested prayer from her sister that we who are young in this family may be awakened and excited to call more earnestly on God. The other two Edwards daughters, Eunice and Elizabeth, or more commonly known as Betty, and her 3 brothers, likewise carried on the godly heritage given to them from their parents. Speaking of the Edwards family, Samuel Miller writes, "Jonathan Edwards' children manifested the fruit of his pious fidelity by consecrating themselves in heart and life to the God of their fathers." Like their father, all 3 of the Edwards boys, Timothy, Jonathan Jr., Pierpont, or Pinty as he was called, played significant leadership roles in society. Timothy went on to become a lawyer. Pinty, or Pierpont, went on to become a politician. And then Jonathan Jr. followed in the footsteps of his father the closest. He likewise became a pastor and also a president of a college. And in time, he would go on to be a leading voice in the abolitionist cause, calling for the end of slavery. In the legacy of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards, if we were to stop with the children, it would be impressive. But the amazing thing is their legacy extended far beyond just their own children. Their godly example perpetuated for many generations. And we can say it has, and to some degree, still positively influences American society. Some have argued perhaps more than any other family. Elizabeth Dodds references a study done by one A.E. Winship, in which he proves this point. And as I'll read here in just a moment, Winship did this study in the year 1900. So as I read the numbers that I'm going to read to you here in a moment, just realize that these numbers were given in 1900. I think if somehow there was a study that brought his study up to the present, the tracing of Edwards' lineage or his legacy would be even more impressive. And you should know there are still some heirs of Jonathan Edwards that are still serving and living for Christ. I actually was at a conference in 2003, again, 300th year of his birthday, and one of his direct descendants was at this, and his last name was Edwards. So there are those out there who are still walking with Christ. Well, anyway, back to Elizabeth Dodds referencing Winship's study. She writes this, "In 1900, A.E. Winship tracked down 1,400 of their descendants and published a study of the Edwards children in contrast to the Jukes family, the notorious Klan who cost New York State a total of $1,250,000 in welfare and custodial charges." Jukes wasn't actually the name of the other family. The word means to roost. And it was used about them because the family members were social floaters with no home or nest. They all originated with one immigrant who settled in upstate New York in 1720 and produced a tribe of idleness, ignorance, and vulgarity. Winship learned that a descendant of the Edwardses presided over the New York Prison Commission in 1874. When it conducted an inquiry into the Jukes matter, only 20 of the 1,200 Jukes had ever had gainful employment. The others were either criminals or lived on state aid, whereas the Edwards family had contributed astonishing riches to the American scene. Whatever the family has done, it has done ably and nobly, Winship contended. And he went on, much of the capacity and talent, intensity and character of the more than 1,400 of the Edwards family is due to Mrs. Edwards. By 1900, when Winship made his study, this single marriage had produced the following: 13 college presidents, 65 professors, 100 lawyers, and a dean of an outstanding law school, 30 judges, 66 physicians, and a dean of a medical school, 80 holders of public office, 3 United States senators, mayors of 3 large cities, governors of 3 states, a vice president of the United States, and a controller of the United States Treasury. Almost all the men had college degrees, and many completed graduate work in a time when this was unusual. The women were repeatedly described as great readers or highly intelligent, although girls were not sent to college then. Members of the family wrote 135 books. They edited 18 journals and periodicals. They entered the ministry in platoons and sent 100 missionaries overseas, as well as stocking many mission boards with lay trustees. So again, these are the numbers from 1900. I think they would be remarkable to see if they are up to date today. Well, Dodds continues. She says, there is scarcely any great American industry that has not had one of this family among its chief promoters. The family has cost the country nothing in pauperism, in crime, in hospital or asylum services. On the contrary, it represents the highest usefulness. I think the point in all of that, in that contrast that Winship picked up on, is just the fact that Jonathan and Sarah Edwards were salt and light in their generation, and that was passed on to their children, great and grandchildren, great grandchildren, on and on. The life strands of Pastor and Mrs. Jonathan Edwards, as I said this morning, were put together on July 28, 1727. That's when the two pious youths were married. And over time, this ministry duo interwove a home life of exquisite elegance, like an intricate spider's web. Both Jonathan and Sarah Edwards were blameless in their lives. What you saw in public is what they were also in private. They were not hypocrites. The Northampton couple was and continues to be an exceptional example of what it is to be a Christian husband and wife, Christian father and mother. As I mentioned this morning, on his deathbed, Jonathan Edwards referred to his marriage to Sarah as an uncommon union. I pray that we, the people of God here and now, by God's grace, may have their uncommon union be replicated in our lives, that it would become more common in our marriages and in our homes. Let's pray.